The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Every week we pick a few of our writers to read out their pieces for you. This week we've got Alex Massey, the Spectator's Scotland editor, reading his cover piece about the Sturgeon paradox, how she becomes more popular despite doing ever worse. Then we have Paul Wood looking at what happens in the Middle East after Trump goes. And at the very end, Melissa Kite on why she regrets endorsing Boris Johnson. First up, it's Alex Massey.
Before COVID-19, if you can remember such a time, this was supposed to be a difficult year for Nicola Sturgeon. Her party had been in power in Edinburgh since 2007, and like all ministries of such antiquity, was beginning to look jaded. There was never any doubt that she would remain First Minister following next year's Holyrood elections, but the prospect of her winning a majority seemed to be receding. Opposition parties believed that a relentless focus on the SNP's record in office would be enough to clip Sturgeon's wings. After 13 years, it was hard to point to many stunning successes. On the contrary, failures and scandals were accumulating. Time ruins all governments, and hers did not seem to be an exception. But, as 2020 has shown, normal rules do not apply to Nicola Sturgeon. The virus changed everything. Now she is arguably Britain's most popular politician, more popular in England than Boris Johnson, according to one poll, and her stock in Scotland has never been higher. Opinion polls suggest the next Holyrood Parliament will be cursed with a pro-independence majority. The future of the United Kingdom once again hangs in the balance. And to save it, unionists need to work out why. Rarely has a discrepancy between perception and performance been so stark. Although the prevalence of the virus is currently lower in Scotland than England, second wave death rates are actually 25% higher. Many of the mistakes made in England were also made in Scotland, not least discharging patients from hospitals into care homes without first checking they were not bringing the virus with them. By any reasonable estimation, Scotland's performance has been mediocre at best. But in modern Scotland, relative success counts for more than absolute success. Sturgeon's rave reviews come not just from fawning nationalists, but also from dismayed unionists. Nicola has been calm, authoritative, and cautious throughout, says one senior Tory MSP. And his own party leader? Boris has overpromised and underdelivered. He lacks the appearance of seriousness to the point where he lacks the appearance of competence. The whole theory of devolution, and now of independence, is that local decisions are better. Scottish solutions for Scottish problems. But after 2 decades, it's not too early to judge success. 5 years ago, Sturgeon asked to be assessed on her record. Education, not independence, was to be her top priority, and specifically the closing of the attainment gap between pupils from rich and poor families. But evidence of her success is so hard to come by that the Scottish Government's own analysis of the progress made has resorted to claiming that perceptions of success currently present a more positive picture of progress than anything emerging through quantitative measures. 2 years ago, Scottish pupils achieved the country's worst ever science and maths results in the international PISA league tables. The gap between those from the most and least advantaged families amounted to 3 years of learning. And this is the opposite to what devolution was supposed to achieve. Despite being freed from the obligation of paying tuition fees, students from poor families in Scotland are no more likely to attend university than comparable children in England. As for health, the other main area of devolved responsibility, the SNP's record is just as bad. At last year's general election, just 7% of voters said they thought the NHS had improved in Scotland since Sturgeon became First Minister 6 years ago. A 12-week treatment time guarantee has proved meaningless, since last year just 71% of inpatients and day cases were treated within that time frame, and 1 in 4 outpatients also waited longer than they were supposed to. Across a range of NHS indicators, targets have not been met for 5 years. But voters are contrary creatures, and nowhere more so than in Scotland. While giving the SNP a failing grade on education, health, justice and the economy, they still overwhelmingly endorsed SNP candidates at the general election. And then came COVID. At a stroke, all the facts pointing to the Scottish Government's substandard performance were rendered irrelevant, wiped from the public consciousness. A weak media does not help. Sturgeon almost never agrees to interviews with a still largely sceptical print media and only rarely faces sustained questioning on BBC Scotland or STV. But in truth, it goes beyond this. There is an issue with the lack of scrutiny of the SNP's record from the media, particularly broadcasters, another senior Scottish Tory complains, contrasting the BBC's treatment of Sturgeon and its decision to show her press briefings without granting the opposition a response, with the manner in which the UK government is generally handled. Even so, there is a simple explanation for Sturgeon's success. Essentially, it's because she isn't Boris. Focus groups conducted for the pro-union think tank These Islands bear this out. Voters who are now curious about independence, though not necessarily yet sold on it, contrast bungling Boris and Brexit with competent Nicola and independence. Brexit has been a slow-burning issue, but it is one that has laid the foundations for the surge in pro-independence sentiment. Johnson has added the exterior walls, and COVID has supplied the roof. Compared with the Prime Minister, Sturgeon enjoys very high approval ratings. Not only that, but many of those who do not agree with her still respect her. There is a 100-point differential between Sturgeon's and Johnson's approval ratings in Scotland. Hers is plus 49, his is minus 57. He is a liability for unionists, she is the independence cause's greatest strength. The frustration in unionist circles is palpable. Many punches are thrown, none seems to land. Sometimes this frustration appears tinged with a shivering anticipation of grief to come. It is not difficult to find ardent unionists who whisper that they think the United Kingdom has run its race. The precise timing of its formal dissolution may as yet be unknown, but the direction of travel is impossible to ignore. A bell tolls, and it tolls for the United Kingdom. Of course, demographic trends do not guarantee particular outcomes. Nevertheless, two-thirds of Scots under the age of 45 now say they back independence. A dozen opinion polls in recent months have each reported a majority in favour of independence. The trend is clear. Contrasting the reality of devolution with its promise misunderstands its perceived value. The Parliament proves its worth merely by existing. It has become the principal forum for public argument in Scotland. And while this argument is often drab and dreary, the Parliament is also a testing ground for something else, dreams of a grander future. It is a question of respect. The Holyrood Parliament may be a small thing, but it is Scotland's own, and that makes a significant, a necessary, and perhaps even a sufficient difference. To slight it is, in some vague sense, to slight the Scottish people's estimation of themselves. If this is prickly, it is also reality. 60% of Scots think the institutions of devolution will work in the country's best interest. Fewer than one in five are confident that the UK government or parliament will do likewise. Politics is a matter of belonging. Scotland might benefit from its privileged position within the union, but London feels further away than ever. The ties that bind the United Kingdom together have been loosening perceptibly. Scots born before 1960 are twice as likely to strongly identify as British as those born after that date. And, just as the argument for Brexit rested on the presumption that sovereignty is more important than economic forecasts, so too does the case for Scottish independence. The SNP argues that independence will leave Scotland wealthier, but sovereignty remains the true basis for secession. As Sturgeon told her party conference on Monday, only independence will allow Scots to be the decision-makers in their own lives. Where Alex Salmond was, for many, a Marmite politician of the loathe-him or really loathe-him kind, Sturgeon is perceived as an altogether more approachable and representative figure. She is unmistakably one of us. Although her faith in independence is unsinkable, she has succeeded in presenting it as a utilitarian choice and the path to a more prosperous, more egalitarian, more democratic future. In doing so, she sells Scots on the idea of who they should like to be, rather than who they actually are. For with the notable exceptions of Europe and to some degree immigration, Scottish and English attitudes are broadly similar. But her message is designed to reassure. Independence is normal. It's the union that's odd. Perhaps the most striking feature of the SNP's present ascendancy is how comprehensive it is. There is no significant class divide on the national question. ABC1 voters are as likely to support independence as C2DE voters. And while support for independence remains higher in the yes cities of Glasgow and Dundee than in Edinburgh and Aberdeen, the gap is closing. There is a further paradox. As Douglas Ross, the new leader of the Scottish Tories, argues, the case for independence is being made more effectively in London than Edinburgh. The UK is seen as an example of how a country should not comport itself. Sturgeon asks Scots if they really think it has to be like this, or if, on the contrary, a different future might be available. The biggest danger to the Sturgeon supremacy may not come from London, but from within her own movement. A Holyrood committee investigating the Alex Salmond affair is due to report at some point before the election next May. It has been established that Sturgeon's account to Parliament of what she knew, and when she knew it, was at best incomplete and misleading. Salmond alleges that he was stitched up by a government-led plot, and if proven, this might yet be enough to destroy his successor. Unionists cannot admit to pinning their hopes on this scandal, and privately, some speculate Sturgeon might be able to survive, even if she is found to have lied to Parliament and broken the ministerial code. A scandal that might be fatal elsewhere could turn out to be but a flesh wound in Scotland. For now, however, Sturgeon is untouchable. She has a connection with her electorate that is unmatched in these islands. A fourth SNP term at Holyrood might deliver little in the way of policy successes, but it will haunt Johnson for the rest of his time in office. He might insist on saying no to Scotland, but if Scotland keeps saying yes to another referendum, just saying no is a position subject to the law of diminishing returns. The Scottish question will not disappear.
That was Alex Massey. And now, Paul Wood.
Last year, in the cigar bar of an opulent London hotel, much favoured by visiting Arabs, an interesting conversation took place. My friend was rich enough to have two private jets and claimed to be doing his own shuttle diplomacy between Israel and one of the Gulf states. Smoke curled around our heads, and a young Qatari in Gucci trainers passed by with a woman my friend assured me was a Russian prostitute. My friend's phone was out now, and he was on a video call with a man he said was a senior official in the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. He asked him about a drone strike on Saudi Arabia's two biggest oil refineries. The man chuckled. Ah yes, that was us. Saudi Arabia's oil production was briefly cut in half by that attack in September 2019. But what really worried the Saudis was how the Americans did nothing more than issue a few tired words of condemnation. The Saudis suddenly had a glimpse of what getting into a war with Iran would be like without US military support. And this occurred under Donald Trump, perhaps the most uncritically pro-Saudi US leader ever to sit in the Oval Office. When the dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi was killed and dismembered in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in 2018, Trump said he didn't much care whether the Saudi ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS, had known what was happening. Maybe he did, and maybe he didn't. This was just part of one of the more extraordinary statements issued in Trump's name under the White House letterhead, and there've been a few. Joe Biden, on the other hand, used the second anniversary of Khashoggi's death to say he would reassess the US-Saudi relationship. Jamal's death will not be in vain, he said. Biden called Saudi Arabia a pariah state because of Khashoggi, the jailing of other human rights activists, and the war in Yemen. When he's president, he has made clear there will be no more blank checks for Riyadh. This was the backdrop to the curious meeting in Saudi Arabia 2 weeks ago between MBS, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and the US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Saudi Arabia, Israel, and, while Trump still sits in the White House, the US, are all adamantly opposed to the Iran nuclear deal, believing it gives Tehran cover to produce a bomb. Since Biden wants to revive the deal and will take office on January the 20th, they have little time left to do something. Did they discuss joint military action? There's been no leak from the meeting, but probably not. A few weeks ago, according to the New York Times, President Trump asked for options to attack Iran, but was told by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs that he might start a regional war he couldn't stop. MBS may be nervous too. The day after the meeting, as if to remind the Saudis of their vulnerabilities, there was another attack on an oil plant, this time in Jeddah. Perhaps not wishing to provoke Tehran, the Saudis deny the meeting happened at all. Or perhaps MBS thinks that neither his father, the king, nor his subjects are ready for peace with Israel, even one based on enmity to Iran. None of that matters, because the Israelis aren't waiting around for anyone else. Last Friday, Professor Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, the Iranian Oppenheimer as he's known, was shot or blown up as he and his bodyguards drove through the countryside of northern Iran. 2 years earlier, Netanyahu had used a news conference to identify him as the head of Project 111, allegedly the secret Iranian effort to build a nuclear bomb small enough to fit on top of a missile. "Remember that name," Netanyahu said, Fakhrizadeh. The killing caused an outpouring of fury in Iran. President Hassan Rouhani said, "Once again, the evil hands of global arrogance were stained with the blood of the mercenary usurper Zionist regime." This may have been the reaction Netanyahu wanted. Ben Rhodes, who was Deputy National Security Advisor under President Obama, said the nuclear deal itself was a target of the assassination as much as a scientist. He tweeted, "This is an outrageous action aimed at undermining diplomacy between an incoming US administration and Iran." But that assumes Iran wants to return to a deal with the US. The Iranians feel cheated by the Obama administration, accusing it of cutting off their access to dollars from international banks once everything had been signed. They've also been talking about getting compensation for the billions the economy lost while under sanctions in the years since the Trump administration abandoned the deal. From the Iranian point of view, they stayed in the agreement while the Americans left. The International Atomic Energy Agency says Iran now has 2,440 kilograms of enriched uranium, more than eight times what it's supposed to have. For all that, the Iranian Foreign Minister, Mohammad Zarif, says he's ready to discuss re-entering the deal with the US. If this starts to look inevitable, what would Israel do then? Netanyahu holds to the Begin Doctrine. No state that threatens Israel's existence can be allowed to have nuclear weapons. Menachem Begin was the Israeli Prime Minister who ordered an air raid on Iraq's nuclear reactor at Ozirak in 1981. He told a press conference afterwards, "There won't be another Holocaust in history. Never again, never again. We survived. We shall survive." Netanyahu, too, often invokes the Shoah when warning about Iran's nuclear ambitions. But he once said, "Unlike our situation during the Holocaust, when we were like leaves on the wind, defenceless, now we have great power to defend ourselves." Israel may in fact have 300 nuclear weapons, as Jimmy Carter said in 2014, and Iran might eventually get only one or two. But the Israelis don't think that the logic of deterrence applies in this case. Netanyahu has said Iran is a messianic regime that would be willing to destroy itself in order to destroy Israel. It's not surprising, therefore, that Netanyahu has reportedly come close to ordering a preemptive strike on Iran's nuclear facilities several times during his long premiership. He was stopped, if the Israeli media are to be believed, by his own military and by the intelligence agency Mossad. Both the generals and the spies apparently told him that an all-out attack from the air would not succeed. Iran's nuclear facilities were too spread out, too deeply buried, and there would be a terrible cost. Iran's militia in Lebanon, Hezbollah, would almost certainly be ordered to open hostilities with Israel. Hezbollah is said to possess 150,000 rockets and missiles. These too could threaten Israel's existence. Ever since David Ben-Gurion led the country, Israelis have believed that their first defeat might be their last. So, instead of an all-out attack on Iran's nuclear facilities, there's been a very effective campaign of sabotage and assassination. Professor Fakhrizadeh was not the first Iranian scientist to be killed by Mossad's hidden hand. Whether Netanyahu tries again to order a large-scale attack on Iran will depend firstly on whether the Israeli military has improved its capabilities since the last time he was persuaded not to act. It would then be a matter of high principle, Netanyahu's belief that the future of the Jewish nation is at stake, but also perhaps of low politics, his desire to stay politically strong enough to stay out of jail. Netanyahu was the first sitting prime minister in Israel to face criminal charges, accused of bribery and corruption. He denies the accusations, but could face 10 years in prison if convicted. What if Netanyahu thought that a strike against Iran would rally Israelis and give him a parliamentary majority big enough to stop the trial? His critics believe that he might be prepared even for a reckless gamble on war with Iran to ensure his own survival. Trump's enemies believe him, too, capable of anything to stay in office or out of jail, even starting a war or giving Netanyahu permission to start one. But Iran's theocratic leaders seem, for now, to be acting with extreme caution. They're said to have instructed militias in Iraq not to attack any American targets. They don't want to give Trump or Netanyahu any excuse. The nuclear deal, Biden's presidency, and peace in the Middle East all depend on what happens in the next 6 weeks. Like another Democratic president before him, Biden finds his fate is in the hands of the mullahs in Tehran.
That was Paul Wood. Finally, Melissa Kite.
Now that our social lives are a Venn diagram that only mathematicians can understand, I am officially becoming a recluse. I've been getting to this point for years, but since the latest COVID rules mean that what we can and can't do until Vaccine Freedom Day can only be understood if you have a head for shaded charts, I'm resigning from polite society insofar as I was ever in it. Boris may as well have announced 375 tiers and a rule saying anyone who wants to celebrate Christmas needs to sit inside an actual bubble and roll themselves along the floor. I have no idea what the government is on about anymore. I couldn't care about what I can and can't do, even if I wanted to, because there is no way to understand it if, like me, you have dyscalculia. Well, why should I say I'm rubbish at maths when these days I can have a disability? Before that was an option, I earned notoriety at school for being rubbish at maths. Either way, I cannot work out who to have for Christmas dinner now that it involves charts. My mum rang me to ask what to do. I don't know, Mum, I said. I honestly don't know. On the one hand, we can be in a bubble. Mum, Dad, the builder boyfriend and I. Or is that a double bubble? On the other hand, we're in different tiers. They're in tier 99 or whatever, on account of having a postcode linked to a Midland city with a claim to being the epicentre of the COVID storm, even though they're miles outside it. We're in Surrey, county of many tiers, where last time I checked, every village seemed to be at a different threat level. I have no desire to start scrutinising maps coloured different shades of red and orange to try to find out what zones we're in now. Attempting to go several steps further to find out whether two bubbles can intersect with two tiers would involve me bursting my brains and spilling them over the floor. I'm not doing it. And then there's the issue of age, a subject that has prompted doomful pronouncements by public health officials. Invite your parents for Christmas and kill them stone dead. Shall we come? Asked my mum. I don't know, I said. What does Dad think? He doesn't know either. And that really frightened me, because Dad used to do all my maths homework. If he doesn't know whether he and Mum can come to my house for Christmas, then nobody does. And if it came to me trusting my dad or the Prime Minister to interpret the Prime Minister's rules, I would go with Dad, not only because he's so technically able, but also because he has never, so far as I know, got engaged to someone who likes Chris Packham. Let's face it, Boris has been acting a bit strange lately. It pains me to say it because I've argued in his favour many times over the years. I've put my reputation for borderline sanity on the line by singing his praises and trying to convince people he's a proper Tory and a shrewd operator. It's all a ruse, the whole buffoonery thing. But ever since he got involved with the animal rights activist who counts Chris Packham among her friends, I've had a horrible feeling. Oh no, I keep thinking, what have I done? I've told people I trust this guy, and now he's engaged to someone who was refused a visa to the States. After she had a reshuffle of his aides at number 10, it occurred to me that this endorsement of mine might turn out to be the worst misjudgment I've made since the time I decided to answer an email from a ragwort enthusiast group. Either the puffin protector-in-chief is calling the shots, which is not a metaphor she would approve of, or the PM is becoming a fully-fledged enviro-mentalist. And on top of that, it looks as though he's making up the COVID rules as he goes along. If he does know whether people of a certain age will be allowed to travel outside Zone 99 in a few weeks, then could he produce the relevant diagram in time for me to order the turkey? Oh, never mind. I'm hoping Carrie Simmons might read this because it comes up on her press digest now I've mentioned her name. Perhaps Miss Simmons, seasoned political operator and renowned lover of Dylan the dog, I happen to know she likes that, could tell him indoors to get his act together and work out whether retired folks will be allowed to travel 110 miles for a turkey dinner. Or do we have to promise to eat nut roast?
And that was Melissa Kite. Thanks for listening to this episode of Spectator Out Loud, and do join us again next week.
The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.